hard-hitting, intelligent discussion, painstakingly researched, thought-provoking opinions, and deep insight when you need it most. You'll get none of that here. Broadcasting from a secret location deep within America's heartland, Unapologetically Mediocre Studios presents the No Better Than Average podcast with your hosts Jacob Cazell, Jeff Chaney, and Todd Singer.
Welcome to a very special episode of the No Better Than Average show. We are on location for episode number 90. More on that later. This is Todd Singer, encouraging you to visit our website at nobettershow.com. Now, after this episode, we are thinking about changing to a 100% all-the-time Pokemon Go format. If you do not want that to happen, call our comment line at 317-643-1212 and leave a message. Let us know if you don't want to use it on the air, or you may end up internet famous. Or you could voice your objections by sending an email to feedback at nobettershow.com or even tweet at us at nobettershow. So I'm here with my co-hosts, Jacob Cazell and Jeff Chaney. Jeff, how's it going?
It's going really good. Just got back from Chicago. Spent a nice couple days up there with my oldest son visiting one of his college buddies and ate lots of good food. That's usually all I do.
I saw some of that food on the interwebs. It looked very tasty.
Yeah.
I was jealous of the Portillo's.
I had the combo, which is Italian sausage and Italian beef.
Combo's the best.
Yeah. And I had the chocolate cake shake, which I guess are famous for. I don't know. I didn't really care for it.
It's a milkshake, and you didn't care for it? What are you, a communist?
It has cake in it, and drinking cake is just not okay, really.
No, that sounds fantastic.
So we have a guest today, and his name is Chris Spangle.
Hello.
He has graciously allowed us to invade his studio to record our podcast, and he has a sweet setup, which I'm sure we'll get into a little bit later. Chris has produced a local AM talk radio show and worked as the executive director for the Libertarian Party of Indiana. I know this because I hired him for that position.
No pressure or anything, right?
Right. He has since moved on to work at a marketing firm and is now working on the nationally syndicated radio program, The Bob and Tom Show. And what's your title over there, Chris? Web director?
I am the web director, or I've renamed myself the digital director because web director sounds, you know, like Spider-Man. It's, you know, it used to be webmaster, which was even weirder. But
that's right. The master of the webs.
Yeah.
Good. So how did you get interested in radio originally?
It is a lifelong passion. And thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate it. It's been a lifelong passion. I grew up listening to the Bob and Tom Show, which is, you know, heard by 4 million people a day. It's syndicated in over 100 markets, and it's broadcast out of Indianapolis, in which we're broadcasting at the moment. And I grew up listening to it. It's a comedy radio show, and I always worshipped comedians. I never got into sports. I always memorized, you know, the cat. The cat loves to be part of all the podcasts that we do. So I grew up memorizing stand-up albums. So I grew up memorizing Bill Cosby albums, George Carlin, not, you know, Michael Jordan scores.
Why is there air?
Yeah, exactly. Some of his... Oh, Bill Cosby. And so I grew up listening to that show all the time. I loved it. And I remember being 8 years old, and it was Halloween. And I was sitting out on the front porch listening to the local NPR station, and they were playing War of the Worlds by Orson Welles. And at that point, it was 75 years old. It was the 75th anniversary, I think, maybe. And I remember just freaking out. And having the thought that, I mean, this is a little bit more, you know, worked out than the actual thought at the time, but thinking if something 75 years old broadcast over this medium can have this much power that far into the future, that emotional connection, then that's something that I want to do. And I had grown up, I started listening to talk radio, listening to Bob and Tom, listening to local. I never wanted to be a DJ. As your listeners will hear, I'm very long-winded. And I always wanted to get into talk radio. And in college, I was delivering pizzas and got frustrated that They kept airing the local AAA baseball games instead of Michael Savage and Laura Ingraham and some other talk show programs that I would listen to in the afternoon. And the guy took my complaint and gave me an internship. And the rest is history, as they say. I started working at that AM radio station. And yeah, so it really started out being an early passion. You know, I didn't want to be a fireman. I wanted to be on the radio. I wanted to do talk radio. So, which is why podcasting is great, because now I get to do that. So,
yeah, cool. I had another thing I wanted to ask you. So, in what ways do you plan to attract new listeners to a dying medium like radio?
First, screw you, Todd.
Yeah. Well, and I have a sarcasm alert on that, because I've been hearing, I think people have been saying that radio is dying for like 80 years
sure.
now.
Yeah, I don't think that radio is ever going to go away. I think, you know, everybody, the push, what I do is basically I take our radio show and I put it online. So I take what, you know, Tom and the gang say, Tom, Chick, Christy, what they say during the day, I format it for the internet, you know, through picture, video, audio, podcasts, rarely written word, but just in different bite-sized chunks. And so I'm the digital director for the dying medium, I guess, if you want to call it. So I have a huge passion for new media. But, you know, so, and the push is always for video. They always want me to do more and more video. That's because that's what advertisers mm-hmm. want. They want video. But the truth is if you really sit down and look at our own habits, if you look at our own daily habits, how many hours a day or minutes a day do you spend listening to the radio or a podcast versus watching a video? You know, even if you're watching TV at home, you're on your phone or you're doing, you know, it's still passive. You're listening to it. So I don't think radio is ever going to go away, simply because I think as we become busier in our lives, people want audio more than they want video. People want curation more than they want the whole shebang. I mean, people message me all the time and say, can you put all 32 years of Bob and Tom up on the website? I'd like to hear every minute of every show. It's like, you think you want that, but you don't. You want the best of stream that we have. You don't want 20,000 songs in your library, because you're only going to listen to the 100 that you love. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's, that's the science of radio has worked that out long ago, much to the, you know, chagrin of DJs who have always hated research. They just want to play the music, man. But, you know, radio will always exist. And I think it's some staggering number. It's above 90%. Tom says it all the time, where I think it's like 92% of people listen to radio weekly, you know, and for all the talk of radio dying, the industry is shrinking, but just like every other industry, you know, every other industry is flattening, you know, so it's just because it's one of those mediums where everybody's paying attention that it's just sort of gotten that rap that radio's dying, when, yeah, there are less jobs. I'm not going to lie to you. It's why I left the radio job at the AM station and went to work for the Libertarian Party of Indiana. When I was like, hey, Todd, hire me, because I didn't want to move for the next 30 years making $30,000 a year, hoping, you know, and all my colleagues, none of them work in radio now. You know, I'm the only one that, you know, of the young guys that I worked with at those stations that still are employed in radio, and I got there because of marketing expertise. So yeah, curation and our desire for audible content will always keep radio around. AM, who knows what happens with that, but FM will still definitely be there.
Yeah, I've got a question. So, I mean, with the Bob and Tom show, it's obviously kind of sketch driven. They have, you know, discrete, you can share a 2-minute bit, a 5-minute bit. Mm-hmm. What's the corollary for a podcast where it's 40 minutes long, 15 minutes long for a short one? You know, most of them are an hour long. And that makes it really hard to find the best of and to share it out there. So, like, what do you, you know, where do you think that the industry is going to go as far as making it more shareable? Because, you know, it's easy to share a 2-minute video. It's hard to sure. share a 40-minute clip and to get someone, oh, hey, these guys really talked about something interesting, or this is really funny, you got to go listen to it. And then people go and go, well, it's 40 minutes. I'm not going to jump into this.
Sure. It's, part of the theory of what I do, what I have brought to this job, is make as much stuff accessible in as many places as possible. Because, you know, there's something out there for everybody. So there are the people who want, we do a subscription podcast of every second of the show. You know, and then there's thousands of people that love that. And then I started a free podcast. So, and that can range from a 2-minute bit, which is a comedy sketch, up to 40 minutes of an hour of that day's show, depending on what I think was good. Mm-hmm. And the way that I judge that is just, it goes off in my brain that, you know, I'm listening to this and I go, God, I want to share that with my friends. You know, so if that happens in my head, then I know that's happening in the listener's head. And so I want to make that available. You know, the foundation of what Bob and Tom do is, you know, the Bob and Tom show, as Bob is now retired, the foundation of the show is really a core group of characters talking about a story or their lives or some piece of information and making it funny and entertaining each other. And, you know, there's always been the canned laughter, like there's just this fake ha ha ha. But I've been in the room. It's legitimate laughter. You can pick those pieces. What's really hard is the 30-second promo that we ship off to our affiliates. Mm. That's really hard, is getting down to that 30-second little soundbite. But when you're talking about podcasting, when you're talking about an on-demand medium, it's some people want the 2 minutes. Some people want the 15-minute drive. Some people want 4 hours.
Right.
You know, it really depends on the person. And so you kind of want to give people what they want in the way that they want it. Do you listen on the website? Do you listen on a podcast app? Do you listen, you know, on your iTunes? Do you listen? So you've got to make sure that that piece of content is compatible everywhere and accessible everywhere. You know, I do a podcast called We Are Libertarians, and that's almost always a 2-hour show weekly, you know, up to 3 hours. Todd just finished a 3-hour podcast of ours, you know? And we've tried to get it down. But what I've found is that people want to hear what you have to say. And as long as you say what you've got to say with as little fluff as possible, and people will gravitate towards that. So what Bob and Tom and Chick and Christy and all the others around the show are good at is cutting out. They've done it for so long that they've cut out the conversational fluff. And then I can go in and kind of trim the fat if there is some.
Mm-hmm.
So to answer your question, is there is no right answer. It's just what your preference is, because, you know, Jeff may like 40-minute podcasts and Todd may like 3-minute clips. So right. you give them both.
Yeah, it just seems like there's not a good mechanism to share that and get that audience that you can do with more viral bits and pieces.
Sure.
And I don't know what the answer is. Obviously, somebody out there, there's a huge untapped potential. I don't know who determines, who solves that, who cracks that nut.
I think the key is we're not very interesting, so people don't want to listen to us.
Well, that's not true.
Not true at all.
I've met you 5 minutes ago. I find you very interesting, Jeff.
And he's an excellent liar, which is why he's in politics. Now, congratulations.
The nature of viral audio just isn't there for whatever. It's not the same as video. It's not the same. You know, if I post something on our Facebook that's a meme, you know, like a funny picture, it takes off.
Right.
You know, but a bit that cost money to produce, I won't say how much, but, you know, there, you look at some of the Bob and Tom comedy bits, and, you know, they're all on our website, or Lord knows they're all on YouTube. Some of those bits from 10 years ago, you know, we're talking 10-piece orchestras.
Mm-hmm, sure, yeah.
That cost thousands of dollars to produce that are legendary bits and pieces, but it's, there's something about the way that social media works is that it's visual.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you get viral videos and viral images. But audio, you got to have a really good title on that stuff. You got to have a really good context written into the headline and the short description to make something like that viral.
Well, so many people consume social stuff without any audio because they're doing it in the office and they don't want that audio to come out.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't tell you how many times you're walking by and you're seeing somebody, you know, looking at Facebook, and heck, I mean, I know a lot of video producers are subtitling stuff now because they know that people aren't going to listen to that,
mm-hmm.
that and they want if nothing else, the subtitles to pique their interest enough for them to actually go into the video.
We just shot a video announcing a new affiliate. And in the video, you know, we did it low tech. We printed off the two logos and just said, here, play with this. So the logos would be visually seen for that very reason.
Right.
You had mentioned something. The audience, I know they're syndicated nationally. Are they international? Are they in Canada too? Or just the United States?
We're on the Armed Forces Network, so you can say global. It's internet, yeah.
I just didn't know how big the reach was. You said something about the audience being 4 million, and that surprised me. That mm-hmm. actually seems low. And I'm curious, do you know how that number has trended compared to, say, 20 years ago when they were just getting started with syndication and were still a local show?
It's stayed pretty consistent.
I mean, it's...
That you lose and add affiliates all the time. I mean,
right.
And so but I don't know the answer to that.
Because I mean, they're still considered, I think, one of the number one, if not the number one, like morning radio talk show comedy show, aren't they?
I consider it the number one.
Well, I didn't know the ratings people considered them, but I mean, I know they're up there. They're always in
that's
the
very
top.
Top 10, easy,
right.
In terms of audience. You know. Radio audiences, I don't think, get much bigger than 10 million.
Really?
You know, if you're talking about like a Rush Limbaugh who's
right.
on 600 stations and shrinking, it's somewhere between, I think the top talk audiences are somewhere between 10 and 15. But if you look up talkers.com, you can kind of see that. But yeah, I mean, it's a very big audience in terms of just your general male oriented talk. I mean, I consider it the top, but I don't know the industry necessarily
right.
the way that I probably should.
It surprises me that, you know, you say 10 million is a huge radio audience. I mean, that to me sounds small, especially if, like you said, it's 90 some percent of people turn on mm-hmm. the radio every day. So, I mean, the audience is it just...
Those are talk audiences. So,
okay, talk audiences.
But you're also talking about something that is... very localized. So,
right.
So it's not like my favorite TV show, Blue Bloods, which gets 10 million people watching it every week.
Right.
That's on everybody's TV station. You know, we're talking about if you're talking about a radio show that has affiliates, you know, one market may be a million people, one market may be 200,000 people, one market, you know, but there's not really a crossover.
Right. That's true. It just, the numbers seem smaller than I would have thought. It surprises mm-hmm. me. Especially like Rush Limbaugh. I mean, you think he would have a bigger audience
sure.
than that because he's a big blowhard who likes to talk.
Yeah, he's got that national presence.
Sure, absolutely.
So, at
the same time, it feels like radio is not diversifying in that, you know, it's corporate and everywhere you go is like, what is it, Jack FM, and it's mm-hmm. the same stuff from, you know, one part of the country to the other part of the country. So is it consolidating or is it becoming more diversified? Like, what are your... views on it being in the industry?
In the Telecom Act in the 90s, I think it was the 96 Telecom Act, it
right.
did, when you had Clear Channel buying up a lot of stations, it did become conglomerates. It did kind of become an industry that would be a lot of copycats,
mm-hmm.
top-down branded content, and you still have some of that. I mean, there's... It really comes down to the music industry. If you're talking music radio, you know,
right.
if you're a classic rock format, you want to hear the songs that you have an emotional connection to. You know, you want to hear Led Zeppelin. You want to hear maybe not the Beatles like on a classic rock format, but like Led Zeppelin, Rush, Queen, ZZ Top. You know, songs that when, you know, if you're a 54-year-old male, those were popular when you were in high school.
Right.
You know, where... hip-hop stations that are geared towards 30-year-old women, I listen to and I go, oh, this is the best song in 2001 when I was in high school. You know, so it comes, you can say, oh, yeah, there's homogenization, but it also has to do with creatures of pattern. Humans are pattern creatures, and so we like similar things. That's why certain music is a hit,
right.
And so we want to listen to that. You know, people don't, and this is a misconception. It's like, oh man, that station plays the same song over and over. It's like, yeah, because you like it, dumbass. You know, it's like
there's a reason for it.
It's why Justin Bieber's popular. His last album was decent. Taylor Swift had a good album. People like
right,
it.
Right.
You may not get it, but they're popular, so that's why they get played.
Oh, yeah. Well, people always are, you know, crapping on new music, and it's good. I mean, sure. I feel like we're in a renaissance of music right now, mm-hmm. and there's so many choices and options. And to what you said about, you know, what was popular in high school, I was actually just in the car with my stepdaughter, who is six, and I was playing an Apple Music playlist from, like, 93, which mm-hmm. was, like, my junior year in high school, and she was like, this music is awful. This is terrible. I want to, like, listen to Taylor Swift or Adele. Or,
right.
And I'm like, oh, that hurts me.
Right.
And it was also a classics playlist, which really hurt that 93 is now classics, according to Apple Music.
I was just listening to Garth Brooks. I'm not a country fan, but Garth Brooks reminds me of vacations driving down to Florida with my family, you know, when I was a kid. So yeah, I mean, I think the future of radio will become more localized. I think there's, you know, if you look at some of the top companies, there's a lot of questions in the industry about debt loads and how will some of these big companies handle some of that stuff. And so you could see spinoffs of stations towards more local controlled stations. But it's expensive to run a radio station.
Yeah.
So, the FCC, not to put my libertarian hat on, but it's very expensive to run a radio station. So you're going to have to, local communities, i.e. the rich people in a community, if you want local radio, are going to have to step up and mm-hmm. and buy the station. So the future of radio is, you know, even if it's locally controlled and owned, it's like the my station that I grew up listening to, Q95, I love it. You know, it's people from our community. It's people that are out in the community. It's people that do charity for the community, but it's owned by a big company.
Right.
You know, so it's one half a dozen of the other. So it's not a dying medium. It's something that is still very popular. And, you know, from my perspective, it's working for a national show. You know, you don't talk about what happened in Indianapolis because you're trying to have a broad perspective. Just like you guys here on this show are probably not talking about the tech scene in Indianapolis. You're trying to gear your short show towards more of a national audience. You know,
it'll
so you're
be
not
a very short podcast in that case.
Yeah, right.
Hey, my company's doing some interesting things in technology.
Yeah. So
stick my tongue out at you.
You know, but there are common patterns and themes that a national radio show can touch on that people will, you know, like Pokemon Go. We did a bit with, you know, our 25-year-old guy Jeff went out and played Pokemon Go, and you know, Tom was sitting there, this is stupid, this is dumb, you know, but and it was funny because there's creative friction between those two points of view. So, and that's something that's cultural that we're all talking about that, you know, comedy can be brought out of.
Right.
As a result.
I just want to point out it's not dumb.
It is dumb. I'm going to be not the Tom dumb in this situation, and Jeff is going to be the Jeff. And Pokemon Go is stupid.
I played a lot of Pokemon Go up in Chicago.
Did you hatch those eggs?
There were eggs hatched. There were Pokemon caught, there were Pokestops.
I don't even understand the words that I'm saying, but these are things that I've read on social media.
We were very excited because we ate at Luminati's, which I think is the most
Illuminati's. Is that like
it's the hilarious? The name of the place is Luminati's. Okay, and it's a deep dish pizza place, which I had never.
That's
heard
what
of.
They want you.
That's what I was like.
There
this
a bunch
is
of black vans parked out front.
I was like, is there a triangle above the door with a circle in it or something? No. So we went there, and it was a Pokestop, and we took it over, and we held that thing for 3 days. We were all excited. It was very, very
exciting.
Do
you know what that means? Because I don't know what that means. A Pokestop yes. that they held for 3 days. Is this like the Alamo?
I can't believe eggs. I let a nerd in my house.
No.
Yeah. You really? Just let one nerd in your
house. One nerd, really. Okay, well, we'll go with that.
I have a the Books of Friedman poster on my wall, so trust me, I'm a nerd too. So, just different type of nerd. I don't play Pokemon. I read about government and stuff.
Yeah. So I was curious if you'd had any examples on working on the Bob and Tom show with social media, something that you thought was like for sure going to be a hit and it did nothing. And then like conversely, was there something that you did that was kind of a throwaway and it just took off?
Not specifically, because there are some things that you like, you see a meme on Reddit or Instagram or your Facebook feed and you go, oh, the audience is going to love this. You know, and so when you manage a community online, you have to get to know your audience. You know, the Facebook audience for Bob and Tom is different than the We Are Libertarians Facebook audience, which is different than the Bob and Tom Twitter audience, which is, you know, so it's which is different than the radio audiences. You know, so you have to kind of get to know the community, the limits of what you can share, what they will find response worthy? What will they will engage in? You know, if I post a political meme on Bob and Tom, it's just going to turn into just, you know, shitting on us and politics. It's just because it's not that audience. You know, you can't post an edgy meme or something with that's too vulgar or too over the line with the Bob and Tom audience, because it's more conservative, older, a more conservative, older audience. I don't mean politically, but just, you know, in terms of lifestyle. Conversely, like the libertarian audience, which is, you know, college kids who are more liberal in lifestyle because of their position in age. So you have to kind of visualize what the audience will and will not accept. So sometimes if you see a meme, you go, oh, this is going to destroy. And you just know it. You post it and it just pops, you know, because memes pop more than anything else. Images, which sucks, because it's a piece of content that somebody had, which, you know, they're funny and they're things that we laugh at, but think about it. That's what you like to share. And you share, you know, here's this dad joke that is hilarious, but it's in picture form. I'm going to share it, you know? And it's something that your dentist would tell. And it's not something that one of our writers spent time working on. And, you know, it's just this thing that somebody put 10 minutes tops of effort into, versus a piece of content that, you know, your writers, your professional writers, or your cast of incredibly brilliant and talented people put effort and time into, or a piece of video that you spent days editing, you know, that you put sweat equity into, and it should be rewarded with virility. Sometimes that stuff does pop. Sometimes that stuff, your audience just goes, wow, okay, great. And then other times it just falls flat, and you just go, man, I could just get some cheap meme and get the same reach, you know. But it can be defeating. I can't think of a specific instance off the top of my head, and I don't want to get into specific numbers or anything. I just know that, that I've talked to a lot of people in various other creative industries and other, like, not radio, but other media outlets. And they're like, yeah, it sucks. This, and I'm sure, like, if you look at the newspaper, they put all this time into a piece of investigative journalism and they spend all this time putting this effort into it. And it just doesn't get the same amount of shares as, like, the news article that, you know, Bob Kavoyan retired. You know? So you never know what the audience will want, but you can make pretty educated guesses the more you do it and the more, and I test stuff. I just try and, you know, okay, what's the limit here, or what will they accept? What, and, you know, Facebook, Twitter, they give you great analytics to kind of learn what is going to be the best way, how to format it, all kinds of different things. There's a bunch of different levers that you pull to try and craft. So yes, they're, memes are the bane of my existence and the lifeblood of my existence occasionally.
So you mentioned analytics and all the different social media sites have differences, what the audience expect, mm-hmm. what they want. So regardless of whether it's the Bob and Tom show or We Are Libertarians, or just in your experience, where do you see sort of the biggest bang for your time buck getting returned? Is it Twitter? Is it Facebook, which, you know, everybody's saying that is dying because now it's only the old people? Is it Reddit, which I'm surprised that you mentioned Reddit, sure, and Bob and Tom. That doesn't seem like an audience that really would overlap. I mean, where do you find the best return on your time investment on social media?
Yeah, but the it's a misnomer that, like, the Bob and Tom audience is older. It's very much a, you know, it kills in, like, the 18 to 34 demo, because it's just that sense of humor. I mean, we take, you know, our writers who and our story preppers spend a lot of time looking on Reddit. Okay, what are people talking about? Because we want to talk about that too,
huh?
You know, and so we want to be engaging in the conversation that is going on. In terms of what platforms. This is pretty consistent. This is not specific to an audience. Facebook is the king.
Sure.
It's, you know, if the you know, we're talking about an 18-inch pizza pie for Facebook and an 8-inch personal pan pizza at Pizza Hut for Twitter, and that's second. You know, we're
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, I mean, in terms of what, if you're trying to get people to take action on something, click on a link back to your website, buy something, share something, download a podcast, or any kind of action on any platform, and this is pretty consistent across creative industries and different mediums, Facebook is king, and they know it. And that's why they make you pay now. If you have the keyword buy, sell, join, donate, do, whatever, any kind of action word, their algorithm weights that post. And so you'll see something that'll, you know, say, hey, download the Weird Libertarians podcast or buy this new hat. You'll see that will get a 30th of the engagement of something that normally, you know, just to give you like a, let's say you normally get 10,000 impressions on a post. You put one of those keywords in, it'll get 400.
Wow.
I mean, they throttle it that much because they want you to pay.
Right.
They now have considered themselves an advertising platform, as opposed to, hey, put all your cool stuff on this so all of your people can see it, and let's all, you know, build this community together. And then somewhere along the lines over the last couple of years, they pulled the rug out from under brands and said, nope, you gotta pay for access now. You know, you're cluttering everybody's feeds. Well, you guys drove us here.
Right.
So Facebook kind of broke that agreement, but they can because they're Facebook.
Well, and to be fair, they are happy to let you clutter someone's feed if the price is right.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they're a business, and that's their right. They build a better product. And if you think about it, Facebook has become the AOL of 1996. You know, that is where I do my messaging. That is essentially my messaging and my email. That's how I talk to my friends. That's how we share information. That's how we, you know, We Are Libertarians is all planned out in Facebook Messenger. You know, so that's, you know, like our version of Slack, I mean, or Trello. You know, that's where I communicate with all my friends. That's where I see all their photos and their videos and everything else. And then you've got the groups, which are like your chat rooms.
Right.
You know, so they have become the internet for most people. And, you know, if you look at most websites in terms of their Google Analytics, it's organic traffic, Google searches, and Facebook traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of that Facebook traffic is mobile Facebook. It's it's m.facebook. It's Twitter is almost useless in driving people to do anything. It's very, you know, it is great for instant information. So the way that I use it is, you know, if we're talking about something on the Bob and Tom show that's visual, I tweet it out. So that way people know where to get it.
Because
it can be a fire hose. But if you want people to buy a hat, it's useless.
Right.
Instagram is as popular in terms of people, you know, the platform isn't as big, but its engagement is as popular as Facebook. Snapchat
action's probably not as good on Instagram, is it? Because you can't really interact. You can like something, you can comment, and that's about all you can do.
Exactly right. Facebook's much more interactive, much more of a two-way communication. Twitter still, for a large scale audience like Bob and Tom or We're Libertarians, you know, for a smaller podcast like ours, a Facebook group is the best way to communicate to our audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 500 people in a group, and then they get to communicate with you two-way. But on a bigger scale, for something like, you know, you see it with celebrities, that's why celebrities use it, is because they're able to kind of have that secure and safe interaction with fans and, you know, the fans that they choose to interact with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good for that, and it's good for kind of instant communication. It really has lived up to what it was designed to do, which is just a quick text message.
Right.
But, you know, for media outlets, like if you're the Today Show, then Pinterest may be of interest. But, you know, like the brands that I work with, Pinterest, Snapchat, we've actually had some fun with. Snapchat's kind of a fun... I love Snapchat. I think it's the app that I use more to chat than I used to, than Facebook even.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because I'm old.
Yeah, me too. And, I've never Snapchatted.
And that's, you know, so what a purpose, like why should an old guy like me get on Snapchat?
Well, the nudes.
To embarrass the young kids, well, that's a good is the answer.
No, No, it is. It started out as like a sexting app because it disappears, and of course, you if you're so inclined, you can use it for those purposes.
So you finally got a place to put all those nude selfies,
all
there,
those
Todd.
Todd nudes that please take them out of the cloud.
If you need some, just let me know. Yeah.
No. He keeps mailing them to me. I don't know why I don't know why he sends.
I joined
his,
a mailing list a few years ago. Can't get it to stop. I
his sexts come via UPS. I don't get it.
Yeah, it's very
single-handedly keeping the post office in business.
Yeah. You should use Snapchat if you want to use Snapchat. And it's like any other social medium. If your friends are on Snapchat, you should be on Snapchat. You know, I've got a few hundred Snapchat friends, and I, you know, a couple dozen that I talk to regularly, and that's our main way of communicating. And it's great visually because you can see the person, and you can do funny videos, and there's filters, and it's a more creative way to chat. But if there's nobody to chat with, then there's no point. So, you know, if you've got kids, then it's hilarious because they love to play with the filters. Like my niece is two, and you know, the only time she'll sit still is when the Snapchat filters are on and she can be a dog. So, so that's the only reason is if you've got people to talk to with there. So if you don't,
I do have kids. Maybe I'll have to try to get them into it.
Yeah, it can be a fun way for you and your wife to send funny photos with the kids, you know? And you
That's
know,
not where I thought you were going with you and the wife. I thought that was going to take a completely different turn.
I know Todd. He's a man of great passion, but not on the internet usually.
This is going to be a little bit different topic, but I've heard you talk about this on your program quite a bit. And I am an ISCH. An ISTJ.
Okay.
And for those of you who don't know, it's a Myers-Briggs personality test measure. This actually came up. I was talking with this with my ex-fiance. She was talking about, like, you know, mood swings. And I said, yes, as an ISTJ, I can have violent mood swings. I can go from stoic to aloof to pensive. And then right back to stoic at the drop of a hat.
Right.
And so I'm curious, you know, you fall more on the emotional side. So how we talk about this with libertarianism, but it's just in general, how can I be more persuasive to non-ISCH such as yourself?
I'm an ENFJ. So in the land of libertarians and IT people of INTJs, I am a real weirdo, and I have a hard time with INTJs, and they have an equally hard time with me. My friend Christine is an INTJ.
Yeah, I'm an INTJ.
And she's just like, oh, you and your emotions, it wears me out. Like, this is just a rational decision, yes or no. And I'm like, no, you don't see the emotional underpinnings of your we had this discussion today. I said, no, I'm not being emotional. I'm emotionally detached, and you're not seeing your emotions. And she's like, shut up about emotions. I don't know. I think it really comes down to play to your strengths. In any kind of persuasion, in any kind of marketing, you want to market to your strengths. Emotional people, you know, I will always cry when Jenny dies in Forrest Gump. When Colonel Potter takes off, and I think it's Colonel Potter, or in MASH, when the colonel dies in the helicopter crash, I weep like a baby, you know. But you INTJ types might not, you know.
I don't understand this crying at a movie thing,
right,
Jeff? Yeah. I have to look at you.
I might have cried at a few movies. What are you talking about? Right. Leave me alone.
You know. And this is why capitalism is great. I would never want to be an accountant. I would never want to do... I'm not a coder. I'm the type of guy who can take content and craft content and build a story. But if I had to sit in front of a computer and write code all day or push numbers, I would be massively suicidal all the time. So thank God that you do what you do, and there are people that I do what I do, and we can all share in our strengths. The best way to persuade to an emotional person is doing exactly what you did, which is first saying, I don't understand you. And admitting that and being vulnerable and saying, I recognize that you are one of these weird emotional types. I don't get it because I'm this way. And the emotional type person will go, oh, that's so nice. You know, I mean, it really comes down to communication and dialogue and just being allowing yourself to be vulnerable. I think there are a lot of people who are on any spectrum. The work of Brené Brown has been hugely influential in my life in talking about, you know, allowing myself to be vulnerable, opening up, being just radical honesty. And I think when you do that, it doesn't matter where you're at on the Myers-Briggs. If you have empathy for other people and have communication with them, then it will be easy to get along and persuade them. So saying, I think you're a freak because you cry it when Jenny dies, is perfectly acceptable.
She deserved it. She knew what she did.
Right. So yeah, I think that's the key is, you know, and not judging someone because they're not like you. You're not that way, but there are a lot of people who have a superiority complex. And I think a lot of people want to validate themselves externally. So if everybody else is like them, then they feel better about themselves. And if people are different than them, then that makes them feel like there's something wrong with them instead of just appreciating that people are different, you know? And so we all have that family member, that Aunt Donna or whatever, that, you know, everybody just needs to be like Aunt Donna. And everybody will be fine because she's just right and she's the one that knows everything. And like that judging person, people judge because they feel insecure, you know? And so I think that's another key part is just not judging or not being condescending or looking down on people. And I think that's a huge reason why the libertarian movement has not grown as much as it should. It's because when you show up to a libertarian meeting, you're met with a lot of, oh, well, you're not like me, so you're kind of a jerk.
Gosh, you sure gave the wrong answer to that question, yeah. New person.
Yeah. You know, if you just believed exactly what I believed, and I'm not going to give you the benefit of the doubt that it took you 10 years to learn all the things that you learned, you should just know it because I know it. You know, so I think just understanding empathy and vulnerability is the key. Which I'll explain what those words mean to you later, dear ISTJ.
What are your thoughts on the end of Beauty and the Beast? Yeah. Because when the Beast dies, that's just every time.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, sorry.
Do we have to put a spoiler alert on a movie from 1994? 1992?
Yeah.
I feel like the statute of limitations has expired.
Okay.
And can we just like all agree that everyone should have to get a tattoo of their Myers-Briggs type Ooh. Somewhere on their body, forehead? Like visible?
Yeah. I would have to take the, like I would have to take the
on
test.
An arm.
Every time I get those tests, I'm just like, I am not taking this. I know I'm an emotional wreck. Leave me alone.
If I had to guess, Jeff, I would say you're an. What would we call Jeff? You're definitely
I'm an enigma.
If you're an emotional wreck, you're an INFJ or an INFP.
So. Yeah, you've definitely got the F in there somewhere. Oh, you're a big old F.
I got a big F-er. Yeah, yeah.
That's
I don't know what they stand for.
You can type them into Google, and it will take you to a Wikipedia link for all of the different types.
That's it, right? Don't take the test.
Don't take the
Look
test.
Look at the Wikipedia page and pick the one that best describes you.
Don't take the test. The point of the I think that's
tests
a good idea.
Tests are overrated when you can just like read the little one paragraph thing and be like, oh yeah, that's me. Why would I take a test developed by a psychologist when I can self-diagnose?
I'm sure I've probably taken it before, and I do tend to be an enigma because I am very logical, but I can get very emotional. So it's kind of a weird mix for me.
You might be an INFJ or an ENFJ then, because I am. I'm like part Vulcan and part Southern grandmother. So it's a weird mix, but I agree. If I go out with a girl, I need to know her Myers-Briggs. I need to know where you're at. And the worst relationships I've ever had are with INTJs. It turns out it's the best and then the worst.
I'd say INFJ looking at this.
Yep.
That'd be my guess.
Yep.
I could buy that. And I'm an INTJ. I don't have all of those pesky feelings in the way.
Right.
Yeah, I am a pretty emotional person. I kind of wear my emotions on my sleeve. See, I admit it. So.
And I don't trust people who say they have no emotions. I don't buy that at all.
It's not that I have no emotions. It's that I do what God intended. I squeeze them down into a tiny little cancerous ball deep within, and I never acknowledge it.
Right. I just took you through all three of my emotions. I don't know what you mean by not emotional. Hey, Jeff, I think we were talking before, and you had a question about comedy for Chris?
Yeah, I just wondered, how is the stand-up career going? I admit I'm a Facebook stalker. I don't know how we even ended up as friends on Facebook, but we are.
Right.
And I follow you, and I'm like, you know, how's that going? I actually have quite a few Facebook friends that are in the comedy world.
Yeah, I have been writing stuff down. So I did a podcast. I have another podcast called The Chris Spangle Show, and I did an episode with Josh Arnold, who's a fantastic comedian, about doing stand-up comedy. And I have not done it yet. It's something that I want to do. It's something that I finally have admitted out loud that I want to do it. I've always wanted to do it. You heard earlier in the episode that I wanted to. I memorized stand-up comedy. So the process is just writing down funny little ideas and then putting them all together. And I find myself not kind of having writer's block. And for whatever reason, for this one thing, I'm intimidated by the act of going to do comedy in front of a group of peers. It's scary to me because I've gotten to know these people. And so to fail in front of them would feel awkward, even though that's a totally irrational thought because they are doing the same thing. You know what I mean? Like, they have the same thought. Like, they're standing up in front of their friends, so why would it matter to them that I'm doing that? So it's probably an ego thing. But, yeah, I've been writing stuff down, trying to put together, you know, like, 3 minutes of funny lines. Because you have to write out, you know, you set up punchline, set up punchline, set up punchline. And it's harder than I thought it would be, because my particular skill is conversation.
Right.
And that isn't necessarily what works on a stand-up stage. And I find that a lot of my punchlines just aren't as funny as they should be.
If only these people would listen to me. I'm funny, damn it.
Right. Like the other day, I was at Earth Fair, and I was at the meat counter, and I was just bombing with this guy. I was just cracking jokes, trying to be conversational with him, and he just was not having any of me. He was not laughing at anything I said.
If there was a market for bad dad jokes, I think I could be right in the running.
Yeah.
A very excellent performer, because I come up with these things all the time.
And so, like, I thought of a funny line. I walked by and I said, man, those were grade A jokes. Get it, Beef?
Yeah, I get it.
And, like,
That's a choice, if you will.
Yeah, you can't tell that joke in a comedy club because the other open micers, even though half of them are probably not, 75% of them are not funny, like, you can't say that. Your peers will laugh at you. So,
isn't that the point?
Right. So, yeah, it's coming along half-assed.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, that's how it's coming.
Sorry.
Who cares what that meat cutter thinks anyway?
Right. What does he know? Look what he's doing with his life.
But, you know, I would think it would be easier to fail in front of comedians because, like, if they've done
they're all failures. That's right.
But if they've ever done it before, they've eaten it, right? They've eaten it hard.
Yeah.
And they would at least, like, they would give you crap and make fun of you, but it would be a good-natured crap. Like,
exactly.
To me, the thought of failing in front of somebody who does it professionally would be more comforting than standing in front of a group of strangers who paid their $4 cover and 2-drink minimum at the comedy club, who are like, who is this idiot? He sucks. Like, that would bother me more.
You heard the choice joke, right?
I did hear the choice. Yeah, you might need to spend more time writing. Maybe move away from deli-based humor. But other than that, yeah, I don't know. I'd be terrified.
Jim Gaffigan
it.
Is like a multimillionaire with deli-based humor. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I'll tell you what
but
it is.
But he owns it. Nobody else could be the deli guy. Like, you can't do a Hot Pocket thing. You got to pay him a nickel.
You're right. The thing is it's not about anybody else. It's about me making excuses to not want to be vulnerable.
It
makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So I don't want to be uncomfortable. So I'm fine. I find excuses as to why I can't go on a Monday night and do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, and I don't know what that thing is or why it is with this one particular thing, but it is what it is. You know, I've learned to be vulnerable in other areas, like, talking to girls. So, and I've, you know, I succeeded and failed there.
I don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah. I don't know. It works out pretty well for me now. That
yeah, well.
Much better than in high school.
I've been married for 22 years now, so I don't have to talk to girls anymore. There's no talking.
There's no help for you at all, now.
Huh? He just has one daughter, so it's girl singular. That's the only girl that he has to talk to.
Yeah. And that's a mess. I do not recommend teenage girls for anyone that's...
That's why I sent her to another country.
Yeah, boarding school. Is that an option?
I wish, man. It is rough sometimes.
You can say that because I guarantee she doesn't listen.
Oh,
right?
No. My oldest
son doesn't listen to her 40-some-odd-year-old dad's technology radio podcast?
My oldest does sometimes, but... So that's about the best I can hope for. But he's an engineering student, so, you know, he has no social skills whatsoever.
Yeah, you already said he was playing Pokemon with his dad.
Absolutely, yeah.
And apparently successfully holding the Alamo. Nobody's going to get in here.
That's right. It was awesome, man.
That's extra eggs, man.
Is that a thing?
Like maybe.
Do you want these eggs?
There's eggs in Pokemon. Scrambled eggs? That.
There is. No, you can't. If you scramble your eggs, that's bad.
That's bad.
You want to hatch your eggs. Yeah. No? Nothing?
No, not so much.
So what are the questions do you guys have for me?
Obviously, Chris is not into Pokemon Go. Well,
I feel
overwhelmed.
Okay, so I've got a question. I know we normally don't like talk a lot of politics on the podcast, but you know, since we have two former Libertarian Party associates with us, I'm just curious what your thoughts are with do the Libertarians have any chance at getting more national exposure this year with the dissatisfaction that people tend to have with the two parties?
Yeah, I think this year there is an opportunity for that. You can just see it in the number of Google searches for Gary Johnson. You can see it in the poll percentages this early for Gary Johnson. Now, I am a realist. I know that we poll better than we do when the poll that actually counts on the first Tuesday of November, but there's a lot more momentum this time around. There's a lot of people looking for an alternative because these are the two most unfavorable rated major party candidates ever, at least since they've been doing polls.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump, his unfavorabilities are 2 points less than David Duke, the former Klansman from Louisiana.
That's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, I mean, it's being an INTJ, I'll just throw some numbers at you, but they're not accurate because I'm an ENFJ. Never let the facts get in the way of a good story. But these are rough numbers. I remember the highest polling that Gary Johnson did, and this was like a watershed moment. It was such an amazing number. He consistently polled around 5%, and then there was one where he polled at like 8 or 9%, and we all just went nuts. We were like, it's happening. But he's been consistently polling at around 13%, and if he, you know, this month can really poll in 15% in the major polls, then he gets into the national debates. And if he gets into the national debates, then I think you have a real Perot moment. Like Ross Perot. And if Gary Johnson on Election Day gets 5%, that puts him into the public financing system. So, you know, when you check off $3 for the presidential electors, that's the public financing system. And that, in 2012, Gary Johnson raised and spent like $2 or $3 or $4 million or whatever. He would have had $72 million.
Right.
You know, so that would have been a massive increase. And just as somebody who has observed Gary's media attention, I run a podcast called Gary Johnson for President where I rip media appearances off of YouTube. And in 2012, you can go back because they're still there. If you look at the 2012, they're all speeches from when he was here locally and I taped them, you know, and maybe a couple CNN appearances here and there. This year, it's 3 or 4 interviews a week on major media outlets like Face the Nation, MSNBC, CNN all the time, State of the Union, Jake Tapper. You know, the CNN town hall with his running mate several months. I mean, for CNN to have a town hall with Gary Johnson a month ago was just massive for libertarians. The three top contenders for our nomination got a Fox Business Network debate.
Right.
We never had our top challengers debate in a televised debate on cable ever. I mean, we had parties everywhere. So the media attention has been overwhelming. In my opinion, the delegates picked the right person to represent us. We picked two former two-term governors that were Republicans in massively blue states in New Mexico and Massachusetts. And, you know, when a disaffected Republican or a disaffected Democrat or somebody who has never really been active and they want to vote against Trump and Hillary, or they're first-time voters, they look at our candidate and they see a credible person, mm-hmm. you know, not somebody that... We've always put up credible people. There was one year that he wasn't that credible, but
well, there was the one. Year.
There was the one, but you know, this year you really have a lot of great attention, and you know, the presidential campaign and parties around the nation are really capitalizing to the best of their ability. I mean, you're always limited in resources and manpower. Trump and Hillary's campaigns are, you know, sure. let alone ours. So yeah, it's going to be a banner year. I think it's one of those years where it's like, man, your head and your heart are with libertarians, and you just need to let it get down to your balls and push that button, because 5% makes a huge difference for the future of our country.
Right. Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that. I mean, I'm looking here on the internet, which knows everything, and as of the end of June, his campaign's only raised $1.4 million. So the fact that he is a name that people at least have heard of, if they're not sure. like, oh, yes, he's the Libertarian candidate, but, you know, people who don't really follow politics that I know at least are like, well, I've heard the name, or, you know, I know he's in the race. I don't really know anything about him. And, you know, to do that on less than $1.5 million raised so far, it's pretty impressive.
It was not the case 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And 4 years before that, it was former Congressman Bob Barr, who was a big name. Mm-hmm. And that was not the case then. It was much less the case. And it's just, you know, we were talking about the gubernatorial race here in Indiana, and we were looking at 04, and our candidate got 1%. And then the next year, the next cycle, 4 years later, 2%. And then the cycle after that, 4%. So we were talking about, you know, where does this candidate that's running for governor in Indiana now get? Does he stay at 4? Does he get 6? Does he get 8? Does he get, you know? I mean, it's exciting to... I've been involved 9-10 years. Todd's been involved a little longer. It's just exciting to see something that... You know, you've been considered the crazy person for voting third party and voting for the Libertarians forever.
Throwing your vote away, right. As my mom says.
And I just look at it and I go, yeah, but Trump or Hillary, you know? And there was a guy at our convention that got on stage and, like, did a striptease. And, like, somehow that's a reason not to vote for a Libertarian. And I just go, Donald Trump, you know, like Hillary Clinton, like those are your major party nominees. This guy was kicked out of the party. These people were put on the ballot, you know? So the Libertarian Party is really the future. And I think you're seeing the end of the Republican Party, much like you did the Whigs and the rise of Lincoln and the Republicans in 1864.
Yeah. It scares me a little bit that there is such fervent support for Trump within even if it's a fringe, it seems to be a very vocal,
I don't know,
passionate fringe.
I have a couple of relatives that are staunch Trump supporters.
I do too.
And it amazes me. I mean, these are people that are intelligent, recent college graduates that I'm like, what? Huh?
It's not as fringe because he's the front runner, you know? I mean, I think the direct connection between Trump's rhetoric is actually someone from the Gary Johnson 2012 campaign and Roger Stone. I think Roger Stone is the missing piece that a lot of people don't look at, but Roger left the Republican Party in 2010, 2011, started going to tea parties, started hanging out with the Libertarian parties, started, you know, he consulted on Gary Johnson's 2012 campaign. I met him in Las Vegas when he was helping Johnson. And, you know, I think he identified this untapped market. And that's what Trump does so well, is he markets. You know, he built buildings in the 80s, but really since then it's been licensing his right. name. He's got this hollow business of just marketing himself and being synonymous with quality. And, you know, he just, the only other person in history, you know, Huey Long was able to manipulate the media like this, Upton Sinclair and his race for governor, and Mussolini. Those are the only other people that I can think that have ever been able to persuade and manipulate the media like Trump has. And it's because he picked a market that I think Roger Stone helped identify, and it's just this disaffected blue-collar worker. And, you know, you guys being in the tech industry and being familiar with tech, we all look at automation, and it's scary. There could be 50% unemployment in the next 25 years, you know, because of automation. And so as we move from agriculture, industrial jobs to the information economy, there's just this whole wide sprawl of voters that they're out of work and they're underemployed, and that's not going to go away.
Is there going to be any truck drivers in 20 years?
Truck driving is actually they can't hire enough truck drivers
now.
Yeah,
but 20 years from now, when self-driving and they all drive themselves, and you just say go here and drop this off, and they do it all on its own. I mean, that's a lot of jobs gone.
That's what my favorite documentary, it used to be on Netflix, maybe it will be soon, is The House I Live In talks about. It's like the drug war was started by Nixon in the 68 election to win an election, because the summer of 69, you had the hippies and you had, you know, the Black Panthers causing all kinds of bombings. You think it's like violent now.
It's not.
You should look at the summer of 69. And so Ehrlichman basically said, we can't criminalize being black and liberal, so we're going to start the war on drugs because they love to smoke pot. And so the silent majority rose up and we created this war on drugs. And so now we're at a point in society where the bottom 15%, we vanish their jobs. So what do we do with them? We'll just warehouse them and make money off of them, you know? And so that's down the libertarian rabbit hole. in terms of what we need to do to reform criminal justice and the drug war and all that. But that sort of law and order thinking, that's what Trump has. And he has this protectionist mindset, which hasn't helped us. And this law and order mindset that hasn't helped us. What we need is vision for the future. We need somebody who says automation is coming. We've got projected 50% unemployment by really smart people in Silicon Valley. The top tech minds, you know, like Elon Musk, speak out against artificial intelligence, not just because of the Terminator aspect, but also because it's bad for human beings in our society because we're going to be out of work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not like Hillary has vision. You know, it's not like she's offering a vision for the future that's going to be any different. I think if Hillary gets elected or Trump gets elected, do we really expect them to do anything differently than Barack Obama did? And did he really do anything differently than George Bush did, who didn't really do anything differently than Bill Clinton did? Like, it's this perpetuation of a system that doesn't work for us. And if it means wasting my vote on my principles, then I'm happy to do it.
Right. Well, it's interesting you said that. You know, Bush Trump or Clinton wouldn't be that much different than Obama, who really wasn't that much different. I mean, it's, you know, even people who are saying that Trump is the outsider and he's not the career politician. I mean, how much power does the president have to really change things? And, you know, what do you expect when you put 60-year-olds in office?
Yeah,
they're not going to be visionary necessarily. That's interesting. I think that's a whole show that we should talk about, just the future of automation and what it's going to mean for, you know, everybody, because that's a good point. And, you know, like you said, Jeff, are we even going to have trucks driving in 20 years? And why would we?
Why would we?
We barely need them now.
Yeah, I mean, people all talk about self-driving vehicles for you know, human transportation, and that's all well and good, but that's not really the majority of where we need to be focusing.
We also are facing the end of oil. I mean, there will be peak oil at some point, maybe not in our lifetimes, but certainly in, you know, your kids or grandkids' lifetime, you know, and mine if I ever settle down and have kids, but I'm trying to avoid that. But
this is an expensive hobby.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a real expensive hobby. Yeah. When you look at the two political parties, do you see people that are preparing us for a future without oil? Do you see people that are preparing? Do you see people that are getting out of the way of technology? You know, we hold in our hands revolutionary devices. You know,
three out of four of us do.
Right. I'm on a 6S. And the 6S, the camera on it is just revolutionary. It's amazing. It's so much better than Android. And I just don't. I don't see how we can't look at the thing that, you know, I love this more than any other person on the planet. My phone is my partner now because I'm single. And if I get a partner, I still might love my phone more.
I think we may have answered a question here.
Yes. And so why do I love it so much? It's because technology has advanced so quickly and it improved so quickly and it's on a year improvement cycle. And if government got in the way of that, then it wouldn't be as good. Mm-hmm. Technology and Moore's Law, things like that exist because government can't get in the way fast enough.
Right.
You know, it can't control the revolution of the internet. And, you know, that's why you see things like, you know, what was the EFF is such a great, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, such a great organization in alerting us to government intrusions into the internet and trying to slow down that progress and get control. And it's all about control. You know, government is force. At the end of the day, you don't pay your taxes, you're going to be killed or put in jail and have all your money taken from you. You know, if you don't comply with the government, you lose your freedom or your life. And so government forces you to do things. And so if the government is forcing us to build certain pieces of technology, Donald Trump gets his way and we're building the Apple iPhone in California, suddenly this is not a $1,000 piece of technology, it's an $8,000 piece of technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so elections have real consequences, not just in terms of your pet things like your iPhone, but also human lives. You know, we were talking about an episode of We're Libertarians that we did, episode 144, about a woman who is not only a victim of domestic violence, but a victim of the system that is set up to protect her and her children from domestic violence. They have perpetuated the trauma because of their failure. You know, voting has real life consequences. It means life and death for people. And so if you're not informed, don't vote, please. You know,
well, it's something that I never hear anyone talk about, but, you know, Trump says, oh, let's build all this stuff in America. And that all sounds well and good, except for if we really did that, if we really said all this technology that's built in China, no more, we're not going to do that anymore. And we're going to build all of it here. Do you really think that that wouldn't start another war?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you're taking away all those jobs from people in China who are just now getting the first taste of what it means to have things.
Yeah.
And you take all that away from them, that's not going to sit well with them. I mean, that's how wars get started, is when you do this kind of stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean, saying that you're going to take all that away, not only is it not reasonable from a pure manufacturing standpoint, it's just not reasonable from the socioeconomic and political problems that that's going to cause.
Right. So I think when you really break it down and you look at your choices in politics, you can choose what we've had or you can choose the future, which I think all of us who are tech-minded look at the future with hope because technology lifts people out of poverty. It's doing amazing things. It's if you watch Silicon Valley, the joke is, you know, we're here to change lives. that tagline, it's so such a great show and such a great tagline because it's we're making lives better. And there's only one political party, one political ideology alive and well today that wants to just get out of everybody's way and let society do what it does best, which is take care of itself and grow, as long as the government's not interfering, and that's libertarians.
Oh, I thought I was going to say communist. Damn.
No.
I was wrong.
No, I think this year the electorate is hungry for a third choice, and libertarians have done the hard work for years to be
sticking around.
Yeah, sticking around.
We've existed, guys!
Jumping through the hoops that the other two parties put in so that we can be on the ballot in 50 mm-hmm. states.
Right.
And we're, I think, finally going to capitalize on that. Chris, I kind of like you to tell them the story of your grandmother this year that you shared.
Yeah, so went to a family gathering the other day. And they were talking about the election because everywhere I go, because of what I used to do, and because I'm interested in politics, people want to talk politics, which I'm happy about. And my whole family is Republican. My dad, my brother, diehard Republicans. My sister, sort of Republican. You know, my grandmother, mega Republican. Like, worked for Reagan, George Bush, W. Bush pictures all over the house, you know, the RNC every year.
He's a handsome man.
And they send out Christmas cards. And you know, she's in Florida, so she's just a huge Jeb fan. And, you know, my brother, my dad, my sister all said, I'm voting Gary Johnson this year. Call my grandmother. Now, when I got hired by Todd at the Libertarian Party of Indiana, my grandmother was so ticked off at me that she did not speak to me for 6 months. Because how could I betray the family
because
values?
Because of a political ideology? That's hard.
Because I
a job.
Left to steal votes for the Libertarians and was perpetuating a lie and betraying the Republican values that were instilled in the Spangle family. And I called her recently, and she goes, I'm not voting for this Donald Trump. I'm voting for Gary Johnson. I'm glad there's a third choice. And I just wanted to laugh so hard at her because she literally did not take my phone call for 6 months. It wasn't until Christmas, and she's like, how are you? How's your job? Like, she was so mad about it. So, yeah, I think it's Trump and Clinton both have – most people don't vote. 20-30% of people vote in this country. I don't know what voter turnout is.
I thought it was higher than that, but 50% anyway. But that's still, I mean, we're nowhere near 100%.
No. You're going to see record low turnout. And, you know, that's good because it helps inform voters have a bigger impact. But, you know, you're talking in a presidential year. I don't think it's higher than 40%.
This is 60% in a presidential year. This is fairvote.org.
Okay.
And 40% during midterms.
Okay. All right. So
Wikipedia says the 2012 election was 42%.
Wow.
The highest was 2004 at 44%.
Chris is technically correct because kids are people too.
Right.
1796, in case you were wondering, 2%.
Yep. So
back in the good old days.
Wow. So yeah, I think it creates an even larger swath. The problem with politics, we talked about vulnerability earlier, is we don't see in politics our own lives. We don't see any control. We see people that get to lie. If I lived my life the way that Hillary and Bill Clinton lived their life, I would be divorced again. I would be, you know, in jail. I would be investigated all the time. I mean, at least one out of three that has happened. You know, it's just regular people aren't represented in politics. It's like this race of lizard people that we just don't, you know, connect with in any way, shape, or form. And so when you don't see yourself represented and you feel like your voice doesn't count, it doesn't help when... That's why Trump is popular. That's why Bernie is popular. That's why Ron Paul was popular. That's why Gary Johnson's growing in popularity. Jill Stein's growing in popularity. And Hillary Clinton, you know, 8 years ago, socialist was a bad word when you called Barack Obama that. Now,
right.
Now you've got a 76-year-old atheist who wouldn't live his whole term, who's an avowed socialist and not even a member of the Democratic Party, almost beats her for, you know, they had to cheat.
Right.
You know, it's because she's so unpopular. So it really is just people don't see themselves represented in it. They don't see any vulnerability. They just see it all as a fake show. And it is. It's nerd politics. That's
right.
All it is anymore.
Right.
All right. Well, before we get on to the next segment, I brought some gifts that I'd like to distribute here just real quick.
Other than gifts.
Other than your presents.
Fabulous take-home prizes.
Present time. Open up a present.
Oh, so I know, Chris, you mentioned this on your show. This is a bottle of zombie dust.
Okay.
But probably one of the favorites, and I brought one for Jeff, too. And then for Jacob.
And from what I understand,
you're not a pale ale fan.
I'm not a hoppy beer guy.
Right. So
I like the box.
It makes him jumpy.
Box.
A wig splitter from Three Floyds.
Very nice.
Nice coffee stout. Delicious.
I like coffee and I like beer, so put them together. This is the Three Floyds, right? You were talking
about. Three Floyds out of Munster, Indiana. Excellent.
Very cool.
Excellent
local
brewer.
Craft cool. Beers.
Very looks cool awesome. Art.
Yeah, I like it.
Go ahead.
Now, the artwork on these craft beers are just amazing. Like Sun King locally, they have a whole art department.
Yeah. Really?
That just does art.
Oh, yeah.
I did
yeah.
not know that. Yeah. I mean, I knew that they were very artsy, but I didn't know they had a whole department.
I could throw a stone and hit that brewery from where I work.
And really, why wouldn't you?
Well.
Yeah, Three Floyds has grown up around comic books and rock and roll. And so they have a lot of comic related.
So the
art.
Devil work is what
exactly.
You're talking about.
And beer and alcohol, which brings me to what I love.
Okay,
I love the 21st annual Indiana Microbrewers Festival, which was yesterday at historic Military Park. It was a great time. There were actually over 100 breweries there. There were over 80 of them were from Indiana, and just you get a tasting bottle at the beginning, and you just go around. The lines weren't too bad. It was low to mid 80s, so if, as long as you were in the shade, the breeze was nice. It was just a great time. I got laughed at when I got home because I was a little tipsy, but took my first Uber ride, and which, you know, Hillary hates, and that went well. So got home, and just before that, enjoyed a heck of a lot of good beer.
That's,
you know,
awesome.
Even if I had 100 drinks of beer, just like took one sip at each.
It was 17.
Tent,
I counted them up.
I would be, even 17, I would be incapacitated. I would need someone to carry me to my Uber.
He did mention the Uber, right?
That was over,
I would need an Uber to get me to my Uber.
That
like
was over
a golf
four,
cart Uber.
A 4-hour time period. So, you know, I had a little bit of time to space it out.
Okay. That's just, that seems like a lot of beer. I wouldn't be content only trying 17 of them. I would have to try all of them. That's because funny. I'm an overachiever. Is there a whiskey festival?
I don't know. I know
it's called it's called a Catholic wedding.
I know there's a wine festival. I haven't heard about whiskey, but there's a nice, I think there's a distillery down in Fountain Square where you can get like a flight of bourbon and try out different bourbons.
Oh, that's cool. I know that craft distillery is becoming a thing.
It
and
is.
I know that Indiana is like right on the forefront of craft
beers
and wines and distillation. So that's cool. I'm going to have to check that out.
Hotel Tango, here locally. They craft everything, even the bitters. Like they craft literally everything that goes into the drink. And so like the drinks are like $15-$16, but it's all crafted.
Very cool.
I'm gonna go with what I love. Netflix original TV series called Stranger Things.
You jerk!
Ha!
You jerk! I have to pick another thing now.
I went next. I watched all 8 episodes while I was in Chicago on my trip.
Isn't it good?
It is so amazing. It's like I don't know,
like Goonies.
Stand By Me plus Goonies plus
E.T.
X-Files?
Fringe?
Yeah, maybe. It is set in Indiana. Woohoo! Shout out, Indiana.
But not really. It's a fake city.
It's a fake city, but it's still in Indiana. He talks about going to Indianapolis.
That's true. Just like Parks and Rec.
That's right. Absolutely.
Shot in Georgia.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, filmed 100% in Georgia.
They did well
Indiana
enough.
Indiana of the South.
They did well enough with their locations that I could buy that it was in Indiana. I mean, sometimes you see a show that's in Indiana,
like,
and you're like, you know, no, that's not Indiana. But they did well enough. It is just amazing. It is, it's about, there's like 3 storylines that are kind of going on. There's a storyline that's the younger kids, kind of a Stand By Me-esque vibe going on there. There's a storyline that's set around high school age kids, and then there's a storyline with the adults. And it is just, if you have not taken the time to at least watch one of these, I cannot recommend it enough. It's good enough that you could use it as your favorite thing too, because it is just amazing. I cannot go on enough. Winona Ryder does an excellent job in it. Mm-hmm. She's old. I guess I didn't realize that, but that's okay because I'm old too, so I still think she's hot.
it did surprise me when I realized that Winona Ryder is old enough to play the mom, and I'm like, oh, when did I get so old? Because she's a young actress, but not so much anymore.
But she still looks good.
She does. Well, not really, because she's frantic for, you know, 9/10
of
the show.
Yeah, but that makes me feel like I have a shot. You know, she's got all those emotions going on, and I could just be there for her.
Got to find a nice wounded bird, don't you?
It's definitely a show that's getting a lot of buzz. I actually had dinner with my family recently and mentioned it to them, and surprisingly, they've all heard of it. Now, none of them have watched it yet, but they all said, oh, I've heard that's good. Should we watch it? And I'm like, you should leave dinner right now, drive straight home, and start watching it.
Yeah, it is.
I think we consumed it in, so it's 8 episodes. Only 1 season is out so far. I don't think they've confirmed a second season.
They already have.
They have.
They did
okay.
confirm the second season.
I was going to say, so you may just get to the end, and they do a good job of wrapping it up, I think, without, you know, they leave it open.
Yeah,
but
it's still pretty wide open.
I didn't know that they had the second season confirmed, so, you know, 2 thumbs up for that. And yeah, I mean, I think we sat down and we watched it over 4 nights, 2 episodes a night. It's about an hour an episode. Really, really good stuff.
There was a lot of Minecraft being played in my trip, and I was not Minecrafting. I was Stranger Thingsing.
Yeah, it's worth watching. The one fun fact that I thought was interesting is that the creators, they bill themselves as the Duffer Brothers. They were born in like 1984.
Oh, wow.
And they do a fantastic job of kind of capturing, you know, it definitely, if nothing else, like the production, the look, the feel, it definitely captures that Amblin Entertainment
vibe. The
D&D
game at the beginning could have been pulled straight out of E.T. I mean, like,
yeah,
that
absolutely.
Was just like, you know, it looked exactly the same. It was, yeah, it's really well done.
It is a fantastic show. I can't even, like, think on the fly of another thing, so I just have to piggyback off Jeff. It's, yeah, two thumbs up.
You need
to go watch it if you have not watched it yet. I will throw this one out, because I watched this one last night, which I noticed is just on just now on Netflix, and I had not seen it in the theaters a year or so ago, and it is the movie The Big Short. I don't know if anybody here has seen this. A bunch of head shaking. It's based on a book, I believe, by the same name.
Michael Lewis. Yep, it's a great book.
I have not read the book. Now I want to read the book. Basically about how Wall Street destroyed our economy 6-7 years ago. And I don't know how much of it is true and how much of it is, you know, licensed.
No, Michael Lewis, I don't know about the movie, but Michael Lewis is an acclaimed journalist. His books are always all well written. He wrote Moneyball.
Oh, okay.
He's written a ton of great books, including a lot on the financial crisis, and so his journalism is never questioned. So hopefully the
movie people were faithful then to the book,
hopefully.
Because you know adaptations always tend to lose something in translation. And you know, if you want a movie that's fascinating and will really piss you off at what happened and how they got away with it, I definitely highly recommend it. The Big Short, and it's on Netflix, so you can check that one out. And I don't know if anybody talked to you, Chris, but
yeah.
We always talk about something we love. So do you have something that you love that you want to share with our listeners?
I do. I was just reading on, I think it might have been UpRocks or The Verge or something, about Microsoft Pix. It is an app
I
for
love
your
it.
Phone. Yeah, so I've been playing a lot with it, but I just took this photo of Mittens here on the ground sleeping, and you get to compare it to the original photo. And so what this does is it takes, you know, a few seconds of video. It captures using the phone, but you know the 6S on Apple has the live shot,
mm-hmm.
which is the half a second and a half before and after you take a shot, so it turns it into like, I don't know, it's kind of useless to me, but it makes it like a little GIF. But what the Microsoft Pix app does, PIX, it takes all the best pixels. So it like uses its Trumpian nature, and so I use all the best pixels. People say all the time my pixels are the best, and it combines them to make it a great photo. And I haven't really taken a bad photo yet. I mean, you look at you hit compare, and you can check it out and see. You just see the difference, especially in low light situations. You know, this photo of my cat. Basically, it goes from she looks like a dark blob to seeing the outlines on her stripes. So Microsoft is doing a lot of really interesting things in terms of software and trying to branch out beyond just, you know, the office days. And now that Steve Ballmer's gone, they seem like a company with vision again. So this is a great app, and it's on iOS. I don't know about your loser platform. But
haven't checked.
I basically have a camera that takes text messages and phone calls. I don't use the phone. I use the camera. That's what I want the phone for, is
right.
A good camera. And for work, that's all we shoot. When we shoot videos, it's all on my iPhone. We don't have big camera rigs or any of that
really?
Kind of stuff. Yep. Everything's shot on the iPhone now. We've completely converted to iOS. That's what most of the TV stations use, too. They use
really?
Something called a Padcaster, and then... You know, like if you're Rafael Sanchez out on the street, they just give you a tripod with a phone clip, and they use special soft, you know, a special app that beams it right back to the live.
iOS device.
Yep.
That's amazing.
Don't use trucks anymore.
Those cameras are what, 30,000-40,000 for
mm-hmm.
a big ENG camera.
Yeah. So our technicians at work are starting to, instead of buying the $5,000 piece of equipment, now you can download an app that'll connect right into the box, and it sounds like radio broadcast quality just from your phone. So
wow,
revolutionary stuff happening in broadcasting with iOS devices. Just iOS. And but as somebody who takes pictures and video, you know, I've got you know, a famous person in our studio, and I've got a lot of important people with very little time, I want to get the right photo. And mm-hmm. so this is going to be great for work. I'm not excited to get off of vacation. I've been on vacation, but to get back and test this out. But low level light, it's amazing. Just, you know, pictures you just don't want to play around with. You want a really good shot. So Microsoft Pix, check it out.
Awesome.
Yeah, I just heard about that and downloaded it a couple days ago, and I can vouch for it. It is an amazing little piece of software. Microsoft's doing some awesome things on everybody else's platforms but their own, it seems like.
Yeah, they have some good Android apps too.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. Just one or two. You get email.
Well,
what's
hilarious is that some of their, well, a lot, mo- most.
Their
most
iPad
of their
apps, I think, are better than what you get on the actual Microsoft Surface
absolutely.
Devices.
Absolutely. And there are several of the apps that they've come out with recently that are not supported on Windows Phone.
Really? Now, that's telling. That's interesting.
So.
Huh.
I think this is one of those apps that is both Android and iOS.
But not
Windows Phone.
Interesting.
I wonder if the hardware is just not capable of it.
The latest Skype release is iOS and Android.
Not Windows Phone.
Have you ever used a Windows Phone? It's impossible. It's it's really...
Don't tell that to the Windows Phone users. They are a very, very loyal and vocal bunch.
So are the BlackBerry people. Where are you at now? So,
are there any of them left?
Well, yeah, no.
BlackBerry's coming out with another new Android phone.
Yes,
after the Priv last year.
It's an Android phone.
It's an Android phone.
Branded with BlackBerry.
BlackBerry is doing what Microsoft is doing and becoming a software company and getting out of the hardware business, which is smart.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they owned email, so if they could put their email solutions on other platforms, why wouldn't they do that?
Right. Because once Apple makes a product, there's no other reason to own anything else.
But BlackBerry is really still good on security. So that's one thing where you're going to get the latest updates, latest security updates from them.
It's more polite.
Is that more polite because if they're from Canada?
Yeah,
that's right. RIM is their chip that they use.
Well, no, are they still? Is it still Research in Motion?
I don't know.
They went bankrupt and
BlackBerry's still out of Canada.
Yeah, but BlackBerry was Research in Motion, RIM.
Yeah, but I think RIM's gone.
I just thought so. Yeah.
I thought they got bought by somebody or something. Yeah.
Probably the Chinese.
Yeah.
So how secure is it?
It's still a Canadian company. I'm telling you. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I think you are right. Again, like a 0.5%?
Yeah, so half of 0.5%
at all on the show. Speaking of, I think we are at the end. Let's wrap it up so that people can go back to their day. We're giving them an extra long podcast. You have just listened to another episode of the No Better Than Average podcast. Thank you, Chris, not only for coming on the show, but for hosting us in your studio. That is awesome. I will have to do this more often, get together and actually do an not with Chris, we won't
Chris, you have a new podcast that you're recording at your house. Congratulations.
Fear overcame me. By the way, how much?
I just mean we'll have to get together and do live in-person podcasts more often because that's kind of cool. It's a nice change vibe. Anyway, if you've got a question, a comment, give us a call on our line. That number is 317-643-1212. We will listen to your message and put it on the show. We will put it on the air. We will make you famous. Not 4 million people a show famous, but, you know, 40 people a show famous, something like that.
Tens of tens.
Keep up with us on Twitter at No Better Show. Visit our blog at www.nobettershow.com. Shoot us an email. We like email in all of its form, and that email address is, as always, feedback@nobettershow.com. We read them all, and if yours is interesting, we'll put it on the air as well, unless you tell us not to, and then we'll think about it. Depends on how much you send along as a tip. For the right amount of money, we'll do what you say. If you like the show, please do the iTunes thing. Leave us a review, some stars, help us keep growing the audience. We really appreciate that. And we didn't mention it at the top of the show, so we'll mention it at the bottom of the show. If you want to support the show and help keep the lights on, throw us a couple of bucks on Patreon. That would be awesome. Your support goes a long way, and you can do that at patreon.com/nobettershow. I think we are done, all in, all good. You have just listened to the No Better Than Average podcast, so now hopefully you know better than average too. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week.
Goodbye, everybody.
Talk at you later, everyone.